Hi.
Hello, Metaglacius.
Hello, Raihan Salam. I'm good, and I am a fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund.
I am a policy advisor at Economics 21, a think tank where we do lots of neat educational stuff, and I'm also a blogger for National Review. And Metaglacius and I are going to talk about, apparently, rumor has it, that there were elections last night.
I don't know,
maybe this is some kind of crazy
I saw it on the television, you know.
And you also were just watching President Obama's statement to the press and his little exchange with the press. And do you have any immediate reactions to it?
I think it was like a lame back and forth, which it seemed like. So reporters kept wanting to say, keep wanting to ask, like, well, doesn't this election mean that the American people disagree with you on the issues? And Obama kept trying to parry them. And, you know, I mean, the reality is that we actually have statistically valid surveys of public opinion if we're, you know, like, super interested in the question of what is it that people think, you know, about the issues. And, you know, and it shows, you know, what we've known forever, which is that, you know, people agree with Democrats about some stuff, they agree with Republicans about other stuff, and, you know, voting behavior is not super driven by that. You know, the better question, you know, to wonder about for both sides after this is, like, what do they actually envision doing over the next couple of years?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that that's still incredibly uncertain. Did you get any sense from him? I mean, what do you think will be the news takeaway from the press conference?
You know, I think the news takeaway will be that he was he wasn't quite defiant, quote unquote, but he was also not super. You know, he didn't offer new substantive concessions.
Yeah.
Right.
I thought that, like, tonally, just this idea that, you know, the public wants us to work together, et cetera, was interesting. And I wonder what you – this is one of these questions that's hard to answer because we don't have any kind of rigorous or hard data.
Right.
But I just wonder, you know, for you as a political observer, to what extent do you think that, you know, Obama as a reconciler is a kind of genuine part of his character and personality? And to what extent do you think it's a kind of rhetorical device that he's addicted to, but that isn't something that is something that he really, you know, kind of, wants to kind of hew to really closely?
I think that it's very real. I mean, I think that one of the sort of issues that has developed is that I think the leadership of both parties actually, in a really literal sense, thinks that what the public wants to see is to see both parties working together. So that there was a sense during the 111th Congress that the stakes, the political stakes, over whether or not there was bipartisan cooperation were actually extremely high, you know, which is a reason why the Republican minority, I think, somewhat reasonably, felt that, well, they didn't want to participate in a sort of a process of bipartisan compromise, the contours of which were going to be defined by the president and by the large Democratic majority, that, you know, insofar as, you know, doing anything, right? I mean, on climate, on the budget deficit, on healthcare, it involves, you know, trade-offs. And so, you know, Democrats really wanted to sort of define the issues in a certain way and then make some compromises in order to get Republicans to vote for it and to then sort of avoid the political cost of having made the – I mean, so for example, they wanted to take this money out of Medicare and they wanted to not get hit for cutting Medicare,
right?
And so the idea is that, well, you're going to do that by forging a bipartisan compromise. Republicans, you know, declined to play that game, reserved the right to sort of use every arrow in their quiver so that the healthcare bill is both a crazed expansion of government and also a dastardly attack on Medicare. And it worked well for them. I wonder the extent to which you know, John Boehner actually becoming Speaker of the House sort of changes that calculation. If possibly, you know, the existence...
He has some level of buy-in at this point.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's just the existence of a more level sort of playing field, you know, between the parties could create more promising circumstances for compromise.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, I think that, you and I, just in positive terms, have very similar worldviews about how this stuff works. You know, when people were complaining about Republican hypocrisy, I just found it baffling because to me it's like, you know, look, I mean, the rump Republican Party after, you know, these two electoral drubbings, you know, their constituencies are old and white. And, you know, it's natural that, you know, if you think of politics as a hydraulic system, and I think there's some truth to that, mm-hmm. You know, there's going to be this energy on the side of opposing fairly deep Medicare cuts. And, you know, they're going to take it on. And, you know, the kind of nuanced argument made by folks on the right and the right of center intelligentsia was, we oppose making these cuts to fund, you know, sort of, you know, for a new health entitlement. But of course, that latter part gets dropped. You know, we oppose these cuts. And I mean, you know, it's going to resonate. And because there's a kind of this degree of instrumental rationality, I mean, you know, they're going to, you know, why would they just decide, oh, good point, we should take that off the table? It just seems incredibly strange. And in a similar vein, you know, Noam Schreiber had a piece on David Axelrod, and David Axelrod, you know, pressing back during these internal White House negotiations about how to treat a tax exclusion for employer-provided health insurance. And he was like, wait a second, guys, you know, before you talk about, you know, scrapping it or doing something, you know, uh-huh. really dramatic, keep in mind that we spent millions of dollars during the 2008 presidential campaign attacking McCain for this exact, you know, idea. So we have right. to find some more opaque way of doing it. It's just, you know, this kind of iterative process, and every step that you take in the previous, you know, round of the game is going to impact what you can realistically do in the immediate next round. And that is, so, I mean, that's the interesting question about going forward here on a lot of these thorny policy questions. I mean, how have Republicans pre-committed themselves? So when Mitch Daniels says something like, well, maybe we need a payroll tax cut, and Larry right. Lindsey has said something along these lines, and, you know, there are a lot of fairly credible folks on the right who've floated this idea. You know, Michael Boskin said that this would have been preferable to the original stimulus, and, you know. Right, but right, the thing right. is that when you make, you know, certain arguments about the deficit, above, you know, over all else, I mean, it necessarily constrains what you can say. So even if we think, well, geez, I mean, these guys will say anything, but they don't think of themselves as being willing to say quite anything. Mm-hmm. They see themselves as being constrained by some of these commitments they've made before. And so that's why I find this next few months so totally unpredictable, because, you know, I have no idea where they're going to bend, you know what I mean? And, you know, where it's going to look like they might be able to get concessions from the president and vice versa.
Well, and there's also, I mean, you know, they're always just sort of the question of, you know, volition, right? And, you know, what do people want to do?
Right.
You know, but there was a quote from Mitch McConnell last week or over the weekend where he said, well, you know, our number one priority is to make sure President Obama doesn't get reelected. Then obviously at other times, you know, he's said different things. You know, everyone in politics sort of wears multiple hats. But, you know, what you would actually want to do as Speaker of the House in terms of, you know, are you trying to draft bills that you think will pass the Senate and be signed by the president, but that you also think are good? Or are you trying to, you know, make sort of message points are different things. People always do a little bit of both. I mean, in 2000, what was it, the 110th Congress, when, you know, we had a Democratic Congress, a Republican yeah. president, they sort of went back and forth, right? I mean, there was an effort on immigration reform to sort of, you know, to really make a compromise. But there were also members who, you know, more wanted an immigration issue than wanted an immigration compromise. And, you know, that's one of the reasons a compromise wasn't reached, you know, more than that the
That's why I found that your discussion of how the president should think about the next 2 years, about how, you know, you want to staff up, you want to focus on judicial appointments, it struck me as very shrewd. I mean, when you think about judicial appointments, I mean, that's really – the president does strike me as someone who's very committed progressive, and to the extent
right.
you want to leave a kind of lasting legacy, or also when you look at the foreign policy domain, and, you know, I mean, this is something that – where it's there's literally a question of how much time and attention does the president have? He has a limited amount.
Exactly.
And he's parceling it out across these different domains. And, you know, that's where it makes the most sense. And just kind of acknowledging that, look, the 111th Congress was actually incredibly productive, you know, in the sense of passing lots of sort of major big ticket legislation. You and I obviously disagree about, you know, kind of mm-hmm. the substance of that legislation. But, you know, then it would actually be kind of okay Well, I mean, sort of, maybe not okay if you're kind of a real believer that we desperately need fiscal stimulus, but I mean, sort of, it kind of makes a lot of strategic sense for the president to decide, I'm going to get everything else right that I can and focus attention that I may have neglected to focus.
I mean, and just in terms of what's realistic, I mean, you know, whether or not you think, you know, a large fiscal stimulus would be a good idea at this point. You know, the idea that there's something the president is going to do that's going to browbeat Republicans and moderate Democrats into voting for it, you know, seems a little foolish to me. Then at the same time, you know, I did think at just here at the press conference, there seemed to be a presumption. It was like the entire United States Senate had kind of been assumed away, and there was this like large House Republican majority, and then there was Barack Obama. But as you know, Barack Obama and all liberals, you know, very well remember from the past 2 years, it's extremely thorny to assemble 60 vote political coalitions in the United States Senate. And you know, actually, if the president were to make himself less involved day to day in the legislative process, there's still 52 or 53 Democratic senators who are there and who are able to, you know, cut deals or not with Republicans on various kind of, you know, legislative topics. And, you know,
do you buy the idea that the president getting involved also raises the partisan stakes so that it becomes more difficult to actually kind of form some of these coalitions?
I do. I mean, I think this is there's a strain of research to that effect. And I think, I mean, if you look at the topics that don't divide the parties, you know, per se, right? And that's, you know, trade deals, I would say, K-12 education issues, to some extent, maybe immigration, you know, things where there's sort of constituencies in both parties. I think that if the president shows up with a big education plan, quote unquote, and then expects Republicans to support it, that's kind of foolish. Whereas if Republicans say, okay, let's think about some education ideas that we think moderate Democrats might get behind, I think they can do that. You know, I mean, I think they know what those things are, and they know which Democrats are the Democrats to talk to about it. And I think, you know, if it were to get done, it would get done in a relatively low-key way, and that it would, and that the president would welcome a bill like that, and you know, could sign it and be encouraging to the process. But that bipartisan legislative compromises are normally made by the legislators and not by sort of the president and everyone's strong reactions to his personality kind of getting in there. And the president does lots of other stuff. There's like 1.5 wars and, you know, bombs in Yemen and all kinds of other things if you want to spend your time on something.
We should clearly talk about the kind of nitty-gritty, ground-level, election-y stuff that I imagine the Blog Kids audience hungers for, but before we get to that, I do want to talk to you about something that I know we're both interested in, and this is just the question of the deleveraging cycle. You wrote a post relating to Noam Shriver's piece on areas where perhaps the president could either act unilaterally or the president could cooperate with Republicans on, you know, either fiscal stimulus or other measures in order to, you know, kind of address the deleveraging cycle. And one of the things that you addressed was this idea of, you know, using the GSEs for this aggressive mortgage write-down, unilateral mortgage write-down.
I'm reliably informed that that would, in fact, be illegal.
Yeah, I tend to think that's true, too.
That was not what Noam's piece said, but it, as best I can tell, the president can't actually. The idea is that the president could use,
and also potentially politically toxic, but I am curious, and he acknowledges that possibility, but I am curious as to what you think of as the right levers to use. I mean, do you kind of see accelerating the debt repayment cycle as really important? And if you do, I mean, sort of what do you think are the right levers to use?
You know, I think the best lever to use to get this done would require really coordination between the Fed, the Congress, and the White House. And it would take some form of essentially printing money and giving it to people. You know, that would be, you know, the helicopter drops of yore. Or in a less outlandish version, would be to do a big payroll tax cut of some kind and have the Fed, you know, commit to keeping the interest rates low in response to that. And either way, the idea would be you get money into people's hands in a way that for indebted people will allow them to sort of get out of that cycle more quickly, but that will still deliver funds to people who aren't indebted. I think that if you try to specifically target the people, you know, who are overburdened with debts and with leverage, that you get into too much of a bailout dynamic. And that there are ways to avoid that with monetary policy and with the tax code, but it requires some level of cooperation.
I had a lengthy conversation about this with a friend and colleague of mine, just on the question of, is there a way for us to structure a program designed to, you know, kind of accelerate mortgage write-downs, et cetera, in this kind of fine-grained way that wouldn't be too expensive, that the banks would consider advantageous for them? And, you know, I was briefly very enthusiastic about this kind of punto final idea of, you know, getting, because there are obviously high foreclosure costs involved,
yes,
and, you know, trying to kind of sweeten the deal. And I was just persuaded that it's just too difficult to do, and the banks are just going to be very resistant to it. And, you know, if they're going to have to eat any of the costs, which, you know, and the whole point is that they would just be incredibly resistant to it given how vulnerable they still are. So that's why I'm actually very sympathetic to what you've described. If you're going to do it, it probably is going to have to happen in this not fine-grained way. It's going to have to happen through something like a payroll tax cut. And if you do it through a payroll tax cut, I mean, of course, there are some people who are not indebted who are going to get the advantage of it. But it just kind of happens much more cleanly. But then the concern for, you know, someone like me, and also the concern given a lot of the kind of very forceful rhetoric coming out of the political right is, well, how do you deal with the Social Security shortfall that emerges? And so the kind of wonk solution, the unrealistic wonk solution, but that's nevertheless kind of, you know, very appealing, is you do something in the out years to Social Security. You kind of, you know, couple it with some kind of reform. And do you think that that's totally politically absurd and unlikely, or do you think there's some kind of universe in which that could happen? Because if you
you know,
me the latter,
I think,
I'll be delighted.
I think it's, I mean, you know, could you imagine something like that? I mean, I think that you could. You know, the sticking point, I think, on any kind of long-term budget issue is that on a sort of a popular grassroots and practical politics level, Republicans, office holders seem to me to be completely opposed to any kind of measure that increases revenues at all. And then at a more sort of wonky elite level, I think people don't take nearly that hard a line. But what they tend to say is that any kind of tax increases, you know, should not be done unless there's a context of overall tax reform. And so, you know, then I think if you're saying, well, okay, well, we're going to do an economic stimulus that's contingent on a Social Security deal, and a Social Security deal is going to be contingent on a tax reform, it's like you've plumped too many things together for the political system to realistically deal with.
Really,
I mean, there's a logic, you know, to, on every step of the way, right? To say, like, well, we should have a payroll tax holiday, and we should do that by addressing the Social Security out years, and that's going to involve some higher taxes. And really, if we're going to talk about raising taxes, we should be talking about making the tax code more efficient. But, you know,
yeah,
I mean, are we really going to do all of those things simultaneously? I mean, that doesn't...
Yeah, that's why I think that something like a payroll tax cut, a deep payroll tax cut, is probably just not going to happen. I mean, partly because, I mean, from my perspective, another thing is if you even temporarily extend the 2001 and 2003 tax cuts, if you then also put in place this kind of deep payroll tax cut, the moment, you know, kind of you know, a year or 2 years from now when you have to reverse that, it's just going to be very, very painful. And it just creates expectations that are going to be, you know, difficult to disrupt. I just kind of think that maybe, well, it just kind of leads me to think, I mean, there have to be more creative approaches. And I think that the one that a lot of people reach, you know, or kind of are enthusiastic about is the idea of, well, we just need 3-5% inflation in order to kind of help accelerate the debt repayment cycle. And that's an area where I think that I just have profoundly mixed feelings. I think that I was, you know, very enthusiastic about this idea, and a lot of people that I find credible, Greg Mankiw being one of them, have said, you know, that's the way to go. But and this is an area where I know that you're completely sold.
I'm very sold. And I do, yeah. You know, I hasten to observe whenever this subject comes up that, you know, we all remember in the 70s, you know, inflation was really high. It was out of control. It was a big problem. And then as the story goes, you know, Paul Volcker and or Ronald Reagan, you know, they tamed inflation. And so what we had throughout the 80s was an inflation rate of around 4% per year. And we had that through the Reagan administration, into the first Bush administration, and all the way up until that recession in the early 1990s. So, you know, the scale of inflation that we're talking about is, you know, consistent with, you know, with Morning in America, with, you know, things that people generally regard as, you know, an okay economic period and not at all a time of ruinous inflation. And right. So, nobody's suggesting a move to some kind of, like, crazy, you know, scenario where we just, like, render the money worthless.
Rename the dollar the zloty or something.
Right. I mean, yeah. The point is just that a relatively small percentage point change can pretty rapidly increase, you know, the pace at which you get out from some of these overhangs.
So tell me about particular election results. Were there any that you were paying close attention to, found interesting or worth talking about, anything that resonated with you, any personal friends, relatives, you know, in ballot races? Did you run for something yourself?
No.
Czar of something, perhaps tea?
That would be the dream. Trains. No. You know, I went to see The Dark Knight in Austin, Texas, with a friend of mine and a friend of his who later turned out to be Congressman Glenn Nye from Virginia. And you know, at the time, you know, he was running at that time, and it was like a super duper long shot race, you know. So I didn't take it very seriously. But then he wound up winning in the proverbial wave. But then he turned out to be, you know, not particularly wonderful progressive leader. He you know, he represented a very red district, and he voted like it, and now he's lost. But still,
how can you say that about someone you saw The Dark Knight with? I mean, that's, well, sure. Like just a,
I mean, you know,
a bro move.
Exactly. And I kind of, you know, I still sort of cherish that moment. So I'm sad to see
when
him
you can't
go.
Help it being a truth teller.
Okay, but this is actually so. What I thought was interesting was these Senate races in Colorado and in Nevada that the Democrats a little bit unexpectedly pulled out and won, if only because it seemed to indicate that, a little bit contrary to what I thought before, that, you know, having kind of like loopy nominees really did hurt Republicans. In those cases, you know, in a context when obviously the overall national picture was extremely favorable to them, that the more you got into things like state legislative races, where I think, you know, voters don't really know who the candidates are or care about the details, but they were reacting
really well.
Yeah, I mean, they were saying, you know, it was like abstracting away from the specifics of the situation. People were saying, no, you know, like we're through with Democrats, we're voting Republican. But that, you know, to the extent that the races have a high salience, the candidate attributes seem to matter more, which I think has some relevance for the discussion around, like, Sarah Palin's viability as a presidential candidate.
Yeah, I thought that I was particularly thinking about this. I mean, I pay a lot of attention to Republicans outside of the South, particularly in big metropolitan areas, and I was really struck by just the result in New York State, and just thinking of, you know, what might have happened had you had a more formidable candidate running against, you know, New York State's junior senator.
Right.
The fact that, you know, Palladino was the Republican candidate. I mean, who knows what might have happened? I just think that, to me, one of the big interesting outcomes from 2006 and 2008 is the softness of Democratic support in a lot of these, you know, even in the outer boroughs of New York City, certainly in some suburban districts. And there were definitely candidates, you know, in suburban Connecticut and Long Island who came very, very, very close to defeating Democrats. Mm-hmm. And it just, you know, made me think that, you know, gee, I mean, you know, maybe if some of these guys run again in 2012, they might get closer depending on, you know, what that cycle winds up looking like. But to me, that's always good news in that, you know, like you, I think that it's a good thing to have pro-transit Republicans, or, you know, just people from, you know, different regions of the country to kind of represent, you know, kind of this underrepresented point of view. And certainly the results in the Midwest, I mean, sort of, well, you know, maybe complicate the Republican position on a wide range of issues in a kind of constructive way. And also, I mean, the big thing that I paid attention to were the gubernatorial races. The problem with the gubernatorial races is that a lot of these guys are ciphers. I have no sense of what they're going to be like.
Right.
Chris Christie, when he ran in 2009, he ran deliberately ran a very vacuous campaign, knowing that he was going to be outspent by Corzine, and just wanting to, you know, be very cautious, knowing that he would, you know, kind of do decently well just by virtue of not being Corzine in that kind of a climate. But then he turned out to be, you know, obviously a conservative folk hero, and you wonder about who will emerge. So, you know, Rick Snyder is someone that a lot of Republicans have talked about, but of course, you know, didn't make national waves. And he was a surprise winner of the Republican primary in Michigan. He seems like a very impressive, competent guy. And the dream of a lot of, you know, right-of-center wonks is that you're going to get a slew of Mitch Daniels-type governors who could then, you know, form this cadre that, you know, might even be able to influence the presidential primaries in 2012. So I thought that that was interesting. I mean, you know, when you talk about these kind of kooky candidates who became poster children, I think that there are a lot of, you know, folks on the left who are crowing and thinking, hey, it's awesome that these guys lost. But I also think that there's, you know, a definite massive, massive silver lining. I tend to think that it's kind of, you know, best possible outcome to have these guys lose that could chasten Republicans in terms of how they approach 2012 or certainly kind of some of the kind of Republican elites that are going to be, you know, kind of weighing who to support during the presidential primaries. So I thought that if it had been a true blowout, I think that that might have encouraged reckless thinking.
Right. No, I agree with that. I mean, I think that this is you know, it was they lost enough that it's a bit of a reality check on, you know, like what works and what doesn't. You know, as far as governors go, I feel like every governor who won last night is going to find himself in a very fortunate situation. I think that they are basically all have the opportunity to kind of take over at a low point of the economic cycle, and then
and then
we're
going to
see. I mean, because you may remember in the 1990s, right? I mean, there was this huge number of governors who were elected in 1994, and who all by 1999 or so had like these reputations as these like glowing genius technocrats who
and all they did was cut taxes and increase spending.
So what they did was they cut taxes and then they took whatever was sort of the most popular local spending causes and they put it up. You know, and sometimes they did some other stuff, you know, of a regulatory nature, but there was like kind of no there. And that's the, you know, the George W. Bush, Christy Whitman, generation. And, you know, it'll be the same thing, right? I mean, if you take over with your predecessor having already had to do really difficult fiscal year 2010 and 2011 budgets, and you get to work sort of from that baseline while the economy grows, you get to kind of be this, you know, cotton candy for everyone governor, which doesn't preclude also having some good policy ideas.
Yeah. I do think that the one area where I push back is I just sense that the fiscal picture in a lot of the states is actually so dire this time. And I guess the anxiety is that the recovery will be so tepid that you're still going to have to make deep and painful cuts. Keith Hennessey video recently in which he was reacting to Austin Goolsbee's chart talking about the shape of the recovery.
Right.
And one thing that I found interesting and a little frustrating about Hennessey's approach, which I overall thought was awesome, awesome and very much worth watching, is that, you know, he said, first, instead of looking at private sector job losses and job gains, let's look at all, you know, job losses and job gains, and then let's project that back during the Bush years. And what I thought to myself is, well, gee, if we just looked at the private sector job losses and gains, the Bush years actually wouldn't look as awesome as they do in this chart, because state governments were hiring at a rapid clip, and, you know, one reason for that could be that swelling tax receipts from upper-income folks who are doing well allowed you to kind of hire more people, but then it wasn't necessarily sustainable. But that's one thing that I find really interesting, and that's why I think that, you know, if something structural has changed about the U.S. economy, so that trend growth is going to be, you know, somewhat lower over the next 10 years than all of us would like, then that just means that you're still going to have to engage in some of this cutting. But yeah, I mean, certainly, relatively speaking, it seems that a lot of these guys are going to be in good shape. And of course, it's going to vary from region to region, et cetera.
Right. I mean, so, you know, I mean, we'll see. It just, it strikes me that it was kind of a pretty good time to win. Whereas, you know, conversely, anyone who picked up a governor's mansion in 2008, you know, found himself in very bad times. You know, the oddly timed New Jersey gubernatorial election, you know, in some ways provides, you know, the fairest test, because Christie, you know, definitely had to do, you know, a real crisis era budget, but also, you know, we'll sort of see him in the upswing and what he does with it. But it's, you know, it's a sort of a I don't know. I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens with it. Because I feel like I've heard a lot since the 2006 election about, you know, Republicans sort of redoubling their commitment to the idea of reducing government spending. But I've seen, you know, very little so far at the national level of, you know, like real proposals about this or that. And I've seen, you know, continuing a great enthusiasm about tax cuts of different kinds and some, like, fairly hazy thinking about, you know, the federal level, federal spending levels. You know, at the state level, as long as you're in a downturn, people sort of can't get away with that. And, you know, like, cuts that are put forward are real cuts. But, you know, in an upswing, it's much easier to evade, and it's not like a particular problem of Republicans that they prefer to avoid that kind of thing. But, you know, I'll be interested to see, you know, in Congress, right? I mean, what kind of things get pulled off? Because there is sort of an internal dynamic in the House Republican caucus where people want to prove their bona fides. So, you know, that may push people to take sort of politically riskier positions than they would otherwise be disposed to sort of do.
One thing that it's also so much of it is about, as you were saying earlier, volition and the particular personalities involved. And I do think it's really important that Paul Ryan is going to be the budget chairman. I know, you know, he's obviously a very controversial figure, and, you know, I sense that, you know, folks on the left loathe him as much as folks on the right adore him. And, you know, it's also true that his roadmap for America's future was poo-pooed by a lot of folks in the Republican congressional leadership who insisted this is not our official approach.
Right.
And surely that is not going to be the exact shape of whatever budget proposal he winds up coming up with. But it will be really interesting to see all of the right-of-center wonks who surround Ryan and, you know, who are part of his staff, thinking hard about these questions, how to make down payments on some of these long-term structural reforms.
But so I mean, by far, if you're just in pure fiscal terms, right, the biggest thing that Ryan's roadmap does is
transform
the Medicare program.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, so he's going to voucherize Medicare, and then he's going to set it so that the vouchers just increase at a slower pace than Medicare.
Right. So it becomes a contribution to the purchase of insurance rather than just,
And then it's just, you know, it's just sort of set lower. And obviously that makes a huge budgetary impact. And of course, you could get a similar budgetary impact, by, you know, taking the same, you know, Ryan's rate of increase formula and just making it a Medicare global budget, or, you know, there's a variety of different ways you could do it. The point is to say, I mean, he wants to put a hard cap on the federal fiscal commitment to senior citizens' health care. I can't imagine anything remotely like that actually becoming a proposal that the congressional Republicans go get behind. So it just sort of leaves me, you know, scratching my head as to, like, where do you fill that gap between the widespread admiration for Paul Ryan, between the fact that he's, you know, going to be in charge of the budget writing process, and the fact that the centerpiece of his thing is so at odds with, you know, who the Republican constituency is, the campaign they just waged, the politics around it. I feel like there's like a big hole there.
You mean there's a big hole for people who are going to make kind of actually realistic center-right proposals?
Yeah, just how do you bridge it? I mean, I could see, you know, like what the gap.
Oh, well, I have one for you.
I think
you know, and this is something that I write about a lot to like a tiresome degree, but there was a proposal from the American Enterprise Institute for a competitive pricing system for Medicare, and it's certainly not something that's going to yield the savings of transforming the Medicare system into a defined contribution, but it's something that in the near term, you know, winds up saving you, could save you about, you know, $500 billion over a 10-year period of time, which is, you know, not chump change. And it's also something that, if you design it the right way, could create incentives so that you have more Medicare Advantage plans that are actually, you know, kind of lowering what their ask.
Yeah, yeah.
For, you know,
kind no, of, I mean, I so think it's a good idea.
And I think that that's an idea that, I mean, would also merit an intense political backlash. When we were talking about Christie before, the thing that kept occurring to me is that, you know, man, I mean, Christie, people like my sister just really loathe Chris Christie and see him as this absolute bruiser. But one interesting thing is that, as Josh Barrow has pointed out, when you look at the pension stuff that he's done, he hasn't even proposed, you know, moving New Jersey pensions to what you see for federal workers, to seeing, you know, get out as a true defined contribution system. He's just proposed doing what lots of other folks in lots of other states have done, which is, you know, creating a new tier for defined benefit pensions that, you know, could be reversed in a fleshier period of time. So, I mean, so it's interesting because I think that even something like competitive pricing for Medicare, I mean, if you say that you're going to have to pay a little bit more, you're going to have to top up for fee-for-service because you have this cheaper alternative, I think that a lot of people will resist that. But it does strike me as something that is maybe doable and something that actually creates the kind of could begin to create the structures that would allow you to move in this longer term direction. So I do see that as a good down payment on, you know, in moving towards the Ryan vision, and also that even if we're the stopping point would actually be a pretty sensible thing.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that there's a sort of a confusing thing because, I mean, if you want to look at, well, what's a point where sort of wonks have a lot of agreement, and it's that the projected trajectory for Medicare spending, you know, is not workable, and it has to be brought down, right? I mean, the liberal position is that Medicare spending has to be lowered than that, as well as it being the conservative position. But then on the level of practical politics, it's precisely the reverse, right? That, like, the one program that Republican politicians, you know, agree that, you know, it would be very bad to cut is Medicare. And certainly Democratic politicians are not, you know, eager to run around touting this idea. So,
right.
You know, so, I mean, the system, the political system is kind of at a standstill around that point, that, you know, you have everybody from both sides kind of running around talking about deficits, you know, in a very sort of vague sense, and you have nobody talking about Medicare spending, as like a conceptual definition of a problem. And, you know, I think if you think about how negotiations work, you know, it's the key move really is when the people from different sides have some kind of consensus as to, you know, like, well, what is it that we're talking about here, right? And if you say, well, okay, what we're talking about is that an unlimited commitment to financing healthcare for senior citizens is, you know, taking us to a world of endless debt, you know, then I think there's a lot of points you can compromise on. But, you know, I'm not sure people are really there.
One of the ideas that you've raised is this idea that with health reform, and obviously health reform is still going to unfold and evolve in various ways, but with that, you've essentially accomplished the core progressive goals, and now it becomes a question of, you know, kind of the structure of these programs, the relative generosity of them, et cetera, and sort of how do you balance that? You know, what is a coherent tax system in order to sustain this kind of a system? And I've always found that idea interesting and appealing. I'm not sure I kind of buy it in terms of the kind of, you know, policy and partisan objectives of folks on the left, but I mean, as a kind of, you know, coherent stopping point, I think it makes
sense.
Well,
I mean, certainly on the spending, I mean, this it goes back to my point on Medicare, that, you know, you now have a, if you look at the federal spending projection, you know, going forward, you know, not like 1 year, but like 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, it's a level of spending that, according to Barack Obama, is too high. According to Paul Krugman, it's too high. According to Dean Baker, it's too high.
Yeah.
You know, and so that then means that, well, okay, you know, we're in fact talking about how can we reallocate, you know, monies that are, you know, built into the system. What kind of efficiencies can we find? What kind of things do we
need? Well, that's exactly where I was going to go. I mean, I think that it's this cost effectiveness agenda. That's why my thought about where I would want the right to go is in this direction of, look, we can actually offer you better value. You know, we can actually both make this cut and then also make the system work better, because here's how we're structurally transforming, you know, the way that we deliver this particular service. And I think that that is something that hasn't been a tremendous focus. But it sounds to me like what you're saying is that it's that, you know, you need to see that same dynamic on the left. Is that fair to say?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's that I think if you think realistically about making progress on any kind of topic, that there's not like some other, you know, 4% of GDP you could throw at it in monetary terms. And I mean, I know it's something that's been something of a new focus for us here at CAP, is, you know, to start a program that's focused on these kind of issues, on, you know, doing better assessments of public sector activities. Our education program, you know, has always been very focused on this, on trying to get, you know, better performance out of public schools, trying to deliver educational services better instead of just talking about, you know, what sorts of services do we want to have. And, you know, it's the most challenging aspect of the public policy world, I think, is to look at, you know, well, how consistently are you going to get quality out of things? But, you know, it's what really sort of matters to people. I mean, it's worth spending money on services that are valuable, but it's really not worth spending any money at all on services that, you know, aren't valuable. And you know, so I mean, a lot of the discussion about spending that happens in conventional politics, it seems to me, is completely missing the point. That it's you know, value is much more relevant than cost. I mean, even a quote unquote cheap program that doesn't work, right? I mean, is a huge waste of money.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I'm very curious to see whether or not this way of thinking really takes hold. My skepticism is that, you know, basically a lot of this thinking of, well, how do we think about cost effectiveness with our existing coalition? Given the demands placed on us by our existing coalition, it places certain kind of tight limits around what mm-hmm. we can do and say. And that's why I gravitate towards the political right, because I think that, you know, the constituencies that I see as the most powerful roadblocks are different from the, you know, constituencies that my counterpart on the left would see as the most potent roadblocks to kind of getting better policy outcomes. So it's interesting because, I mean, so many of these things, when you kind of broadly see the problems, you know, kind of mm-hmm. in a similar way, come down to, you know, actually in terms of that kind of ground level action, you know what I mean? Like, who's going to stop you? And that's why I feel, as many people do, that this kind of, you know, morbid fixation on public sector workers is actually a really good thing. I think that, you know, kind of it can, you know, there's a lot of mm-hmm. misinformation sort of that's a part of this, but I think that, you know, kind of it's, I tend to see the misinformation coming from the left, but I mean, you know, blah, blah, blah. But I think that it's because it goes directly to this question of, well, I mean, do we actually have the right level of autonomy for public sector workers,
right.
for example? You know, are they able to do their jobs as well as they can? And I think that when you were talking about how, well, we don't just have another 4% of GDP, my anxiety on that comes from, you know, the experience of public education and the way that you've seen this kind of really galloping growth. And a lot of that has to do with the constituents that are driving it, I mean, sort of, you know, derive their income. And also there's this kind of normative kind of architecture built around that kind of class interest. And also I think that, you know, you certainly do see societies where, you know, you see government occupying an ever larger share of GDP. The difference is that those societies tend to rely heavily on consumption taxes that are, you know, relatively flat.
Well, also, I don't think benefits. You quite do. I mean, I think the experience of the Nordic countries is that they all popped above 50% of GDP, and then they turned around. You know, I'm, and so I think they'll settle in the high 40s. You know, which is would we higher that? But that's not actually a lot higher. You know, than where America is when you take state and local functions into account. So,
yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I think that, and that's also there are a lot of. There are a lot of folks on the left who said, and it's something that's frustrating to me, but I think there's something to it, this idea that, well, we on the left don't care about the size of government per se, whereas you guys are fixated on the size. And I don't think that's entirely fair. I mean, I've always thought of it as a scope issue rather than the size. But I think that's certainly true. I think that when people talk about, you know, small government in the United States, they ignore tax expenditures, and oftentimes will ignore the weight of state and local government. So I think that's definitely a very important thing to keep in mind. And I guess for me, it also comes down to how do you achieve that greater cost effectiveness? And I guess I think that the levers are a little different. I mean, I think that one of the best levers would be a more competitive, you know, federal system. Mm-hmm. So get rid of the state and local tax deduction, see to it that states are actually, you know, they have much more autonomy vis-a-vis how they run their Medicaid programs, et cetera. And then you can have this real kind of robust TBU choice and also, you know, kind of competition for better models. But yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, sort of this idea that, you know, it's not a constant creep, but that in the Northern European experience, once you get to that point, then you have a ratchet back.
But you know, part of what you have in the Northern European experience, I mean, because I agree with some of what you said about political coalitions. You know, the big sort of challenge that the Northern European right faced politically, and it's a challenge that I think certainly in Sweden and Denmark. And Finland, they met, is that they became credible to the voting public as people who believed in the welfare state. You know, so that it was seen by the voters that when we say from the Alliance for Sweden, when we say, look, you know, we need to keep these costs under control, we need to take on some of the vested interests, we need to reform some of these programs, that wasn't seen, you know, by the median Swede as like code for we're going to eliminate it. And if you look at how the Social Democrats campaign against them, you know, they say, no, it is, you know, Reinfeldt, he's going to tear this whole system apart. Sweden is going to be America. You know, and the voters, you know, they didn't believe that message. You know, and so he's been in, he seems to me to have been a sort of a successful, prime minister. You know, and I don't think that that's certainly the rhetoric. I mean, of a lot of Republican members of Congress does not like really instill a ton of confidence that, you know, they are actually really concerned about the fate of poor people who rely on social services, and that part of that concern is that they worry that the services are not being provided efficiently. You know, you hear a lot of stuff about Ayn Rand and the road to serfdom and you know, yada, yada, yada. And so I you know, because I believe that it's – I mean, I believe in democracy and the alternation of power. But, I mean, I also just think – I think it's important for right-of-center political parties to take office now and again and perform some of the cleansing of public functions that takes place. But I like to see that happen – you know, in a spirit of sort of good faith about it and not just a kind of, you know, a wrecking ball. I mean, it's the old thing about weak claims versus weak claimants.
And this is also a rhetorical
trap it's not something I've particularly seen.
This is a rhetorical trap that some have criticized Paul Ryan for. Ryan is someone who I find very impressive, but he's also someone who, and Will Wilkinson has written about this, has this double move where he both is very drawn to this Randian language and this kind of hard classical liberal language, but on the other hand is saying that, well, look, you should trust me that I really do want to create this kind of viable, sustainable safety net. But, I mean, there's nothing in the kind of normative piece of what he's saying that explains why it kind of flows into his desire to kind of preserve that safety net. And I think that is definitely a real challenge. I don't think it's an insurmountable challenge for the right, and I'm optimistic about the prospect of the right figuring out how to talk about that in a coherent way. But I definitely think it's a challenge. And I guess, the big thing is, I think that I have a somewhat more radical vision of what we can accomplish through personalization. Or, when I think about what we can do in the education space, I mean, I just kind of imagine us spending spending half as much and delivering, much, much better outcomes, for example. And that's just, kind of a real
empirical question. I mean, I think on education, where I'm sort of most engaged with this and most familiar with it, to me, the big difference of opinion between sort of smart people on the right and reform-oriented people on the left is that, Rick Hess, for example, seems to me to believe in a kind of a catastrophist theory of school reform, where if you are kind of just able to say to existing school bureaucracies, you're facing imminent doom. Your budget is just going down. Your fiscal constraint is super sharp. The whole thing is going to fall apart tomorrow. That kind of crisis, spurs reform, which I think is unduly optimistic. About what the likely outcome of these kind of things is going to be, and that the tendency, it seems to me, is that for useful reforms, I'm a liberal, I'm a softie about these things, and I feel like useful kind of structural changes often require a little bit of extra dough in the short term
that was certainly the experience with welfare reform in the mid-90s, the reform of public housing,
exactly, to kind of pay some people off. Unfortunately, the problem with having delayed a lot of reforms, for the past 15, 20 years that we should have been doing, is that we're getting closer and closer to the demographically driven fiscal crunch, which makes it harder and harder to say, we're going to have a 5-year, expansion of what we're spending to kind of, float the system and reform some things. When you start getting to the point where, Medicare, Medicaid, and just the growing number of people on Social Security mean you need to start cutting things, I think there's a risk that you're then not going to be able to pull off any kind of sort of imaginative rethinkings of the kind we had with welfare.
I don't know what I think about the catastrophe theory, because I think that, to me, a lot of it depends on which policy domain are we talking about. I think that there is a tendency, the kind of panicked cutting that happens when I think about the cuts that happen in New York State, where I live, it's incredible, how much of the cuts happen to things like road maintenance. It's a scandal. And it's also just it's exactly the kind of thing that's going to generate massive costs in the relatively near future. And so that makes me think, catastrophe bad in that instance. But on the other hand, I think there are other domains where, when you kind of forestall some of the crunch, then it actually is just one of them. It's like pretend and extend, where you just kind of do that forever.
Uh-huh.
So I think that you see some of that with education, because, with education, you could say that, this was an opportunity to kind of have the leverage in order to put through certain reforms. But the problem is, the leverage to pursue which reforms. You actually have to have reform agendas on the shelf in order to be able to deploy them. And one problem is that, there's been so little you know, really rigorous thinking about, well, what exactly would it involve to actually make education more cost-effective? And that's why I certainly agree that when you're thinking about the think tank space and sort of the academic world, et cetera, I mean, that's something where, you know, both on the right and left, you need to have much more investment in thinking about, you know, what does it mean to stretch the school dollar, to, you know, kind of quote the title of a book Rick Hess recently edited. I just realized that we're very short on time.
We are.
I feel like we should say something about some kind of campaign or maybe one of these personalities who indulge in witchcraft and that kind of thing. Is there anything that you want to tell our audience that is a little bit more political-ish?
You know, I think that everybody should look up the American Prospects profile of Harry Reid that ran earlier this year that explains a sort of fascinating backstory of his efforts to manipulate political events in the state of Nevada so as to get this weak candidate for him to line up against and secure re-election despite having incredibly low approval ratings for a very long period of time. It's something that I think that the press has really kind of treated this as a fluke occurrence in a way that it sort of wasn't.
Who wrote it?
That's a good question. I would look it up, but I've been told I need to turn my browser off to record
that.
That
actually sounds really, really fascinating.
Yeah.
I guess the only political-y thing I have to say is I think that congressional Republicans did a pretty bad and undistinguished job between, you know, 1994 and 2006. And part of the reason was I don't think they had the right theory of how to think about legislating and the right theory of how to think about what to do with the pretty impressive power that they wielded, particularly during the Bush years. And I really hope that people are thinking hard about this question, because I think this is a, you know, really fateful, important moment. And I think that congressional conservatives could do a lot of good stuff if they think rigorously about what they need to do. So, yeah, very earnest for me.
See, I'd be more generous to them, even. I think that 1995, 1996, 1997 were underrated years for legislating.
Oh, if you're talking about, like, the balanced budget amendment of 97 and stuff like that, I mean,
I think the 96 Telecommunications Act is, like, a very important law that nobody claims credit for.
Oh, okay, I can ratchet it back to 98
yes.
to...
I mean, after impeachment mania began, I think the productivity of that congressional majority became kind of low.
We all caught the fever. I was a left-wing Clinton disliker before I became a right-wing Clinton disliker, yeah. And now in hindsight, just reading about, just reading the stuff about how Clinton and Gingrich had, you know, really coalesced around a lot of questions about how to think about Medicare and that kind of thing. It's just so depressing to see what happened next. So I do regret my youthful Christopher Hitchens reading Clinton Hating Self from the late 1990s.
All right. So let's leave it with that.
Thank you very much for joining me. All right. Take care, you guys.
Great.